So there were kind of two different things here. One was the concern about whether in sort of this current state system, whether it's a good idea to turn to states as the guarantors of these extra human rights. And I guess there I'm inclined to say, well, it's pretty contextual in some cases. It might be useful in other cases. It just really strengthens state power and we should do it another way. But the second was your more positive claim that even in the absence of states, that human rights is a good normative framework for thinking about, framework for thinking about what we should do and whatnot. And there I'm less clear about, you know, that I'm not convinced. I mean, I completely agree with what you said at the end, that it's about, you know, that women's human rights ought to be about dismantling patriarchy. But I'm pretty suspicious of whether human rights discourse is going to go very far in that. I mean, human rights discourse is sort of inherently this deontological structure. It's a bunch of rules. gotta have this. And first of all, they leave an awful lot out. I mean, how do you discuss things like internalized oppression or alienated labor or things of this sort, which don't seem to have any problems from the framework of human rights? I mean, if you've chosen to adopt this mundane work and no one's putting a gun to your head and stuff like that, or not bothering you, but it's clearly could be a deep problem of patriarchy or something like that. I mean, to me, the human rights talk actually only makes sense when we've got states and we're saying, well, given that we've got these incredibly powerful institutions, maybe we should put some absolute limits on what they can do. But if we didn't have them, I'd personally look for a much more flexible normative framework for discussing the questions of how we should live together and things like that. I'm not sure why that discourse survives as a good one post states. That's not really an argument, but
I think it's a good point. And I think the reason why we can't envision human rights outside of a nation-state system is because the very reason it developed is a reaction to, you know, some of the egregious things that happened at the end of the Second World War. And so, you know, if you contextualize it that way, then it only seems necessary that we would have it in a nation-state system. But I mean, looking at things like some of the ancient ethical traditions and even some of the biblical traditions, you know, there is. Human rights is there, and it's not necessarily, like, I guess what I'm trying to advance is that it doesn't necessarily have to be tied so closely with the nation-state system, and there's ways that we can use the discourse itself to subvert the power of nation-states and put claims of rights back into the hands of individuals that isn't so necessarily tied to structures of law and nation-states in general. Does that make sense?
Well, it makes sense. I mean, and certainly the idea of using it against them, I mean, I do it all the time. I mean,
right.
I always, in practical work. But, yeah, I mean, I guess the point is just that if we're imagining structures for discussing the normativity outside of state legal systems, there are a lot of competitors, and we'd have to look at all. I mean, yeah, there are ancient traditions that look rather like human rights, but there's also other ones that look nothing at all like them, like Aristotelian discussions of flourishing lives. Doesn't look anything like talk of human rights, and there's consequentialist frameworks. There's all kinds of frameworks out there, and I think, I guess I just think it seemed like there was a move from, you know, this is a useful thing to have for limiting states and a discourse, and I certainly think you're right that we don't have to always look to states to do the positive thing, we can use it to restrict states. The move from that to it would still hang around and be the most useful one after. I mean, I think you'd have to evaluate it against all these other competitors, that's all.
Yeah, I think that's a good point.
I kind of wanted to respond to one point he made. And I might get scoffed here, but why not drawing, instead of a nation-state system, using a natural law system to, if we realize, for example, that a right is an expression of justice spoken of from the beneficiary of that justice. In other words, if we define justice as saying giving a person what they're due, and we know what that is in the normative sense that you were speaking about, then that person has can say, based on how they understand justice, to say that justice requires this or that towards me, or in other words, I have a right to it. So when we use natural law instead of state law, we ought to be able to draw forward to extract out of that normative system that would eliminate patriarchy. That's all I wanted to say, but I appreciated your thought.
I mean, kind of piggybacking off of both of you, I'm seeing like the distinction I was kind of seeing between, like, we were discussing this human rights discourse generally being about acts of the state on a sort of universal sort of subject or person or whatever that tends to be extremely gendered towards men. And that the distinction you're making is the ways in which the state is implicated in, so we're talking, in that sense you're talking about restrictions on the behaviors of states towards the people living under them. And with women's human rights violations, you're talking about the state's complicity in not effectively or productively promoting a particular standard of behavior, right? So it seems like it's two different sort of modalities. One is sort of restricting a particular, restricting behaviors, and the other is encouraging or producing or proliferating behaviors. And it seems like that's the front that, like, anarchists have, or, you know, people who are opposed to state power or whatever, have some capacity to actually play a role in, because it doesn't require, explain it. It seems like that's the intersection that we're looking for, and it's not so much about human rights discourse at all. Like, it's not about rights at all. It's not about restricting the power of a particular institution or the rights that that subjects living under it have. It's about generating and proliferating particular standards or behaviors or attitudes or whatever, and it doesn't even, in my mind, have a whole lot of relationship to rights. It has a whole other, it's a whole other set of practices in my mind, but maybe it's just because I'm not as familiar with that, with human rights discourse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fair point, but I also think, you know, you were talking about natural law, right? Like, you don't, I mean, a lot of human rights discourse, you know, a lot of things influencing that is a concept of natural law, which really has no bearing in relationships of state power to citizens or anything at all. And, you know, whether we call it human rights, whether we call it human dignity, it doesn't really matter what we call it. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. You know, I guess what I'm trying to say is that, you know, we have these very influential documents, you know, that sound really, really good on paper, right? And they're much more difficult to realize in practice, like if you look at the CEDAW Convention. But I think that it's important to have these documents and to have these statements, sure, to use as a normative framework for advancing the sort of society you want to envision. So, you know, I guess, you know, I'm not entirely wedded to, you know, calling things human rights and saying that, you know, this is what human rights are. You know, I'm not that necessarily tied to that discourse.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, I'm just saying that it provides like a normative context for advancing a lot of the changes.
So you're looking at it tactically then?
Right.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. In some way, yeah.
Okay.
Silence in the room. Have I like confused everybody?
I was thinking about some of the ideas you were mentioning about reconciliation, and I'm really interested if you've given that really looked at that concept with anarchist theory, and if you have any more to say about that. I mean, I'm thinking in particular about like the Gacaca movements in Rwanda and the community courts. And, you know, I know that there's things that came out of that that were beneficial in terms of the communion coming together and holding one another accountable, and things that were completely egregious with it, people getting, you know, not go, sort of going how it's supposed to, but, or people not being held accountable. Mm-hmm. But I'm sort of wondering, you know, in terms of those sorts of, you know, practices, if there's anything that's being put up as a model, or any thoughts for that?
Yeah, I'm actually glad you brought that up, because I brought this book. It's a very important book. Andrea Smith, she's a professor at the University of Michigan. She just came out with this book, and it's called Conquest, Sexual Violence, and American Indian Genocide. And she advances the framework you're talking about, restorative justice. And she's talking specifically in the context of violence against Native American women who have incidence of domestic violence which is twice as high as any other population in the United States. And her sort of thesis is that, you know, if you look at Native American populations, it's not necessarily a good move to be using the state to implement, you know, to implement anything, basically. But specifically in the case of violence against women, right? We don't want, you know, a colonial state coming in to Native American populations to say, this is how we need to address violence in your community. And so this is a big theoretical problem. How do you address this? And so this book is sort of advancing a restorative justice framework of looking at, you know, anti-state, anti-colonial practices for dealing with human rights violations, but also with working at preventing them from occurring in the first place, which is the more important point. And she's got a whole, you know, sort of chapter on anti-colonial responses to gender violence, which sort of points people in the direction of the way we should be thinking about things. So, for example, she would be very against something like VAWA, the Violence Against Women Act, which basically, like, you know, tries to, like, incarcerate men who are committing, you know, violence against women, and does all sorts of things. And she advocates for a more community-based approach to dealing with incidences of violence, but also with things like you know, things like poverty is a form of structural violence. And so when you talk about women's human rights, you can't just talk about, like, you know, outright physical acts of violence. You have to talk about things like, well, what about structural features of the liberal capitalist state, for instance? Look at the fact that, you know, women are more likely to be impoverished than any other population. So you have to take those things into account too. I mean, read the book. I can't really.
What's the title of it?
Oh, it's called Conquest, Sexual Violence and American Indian Genocide. And it's on South End Press by Andrea Smith. So.
It's for sale at the South End Press.
Oh, is it here? Oh, okay. We'll pick it up here.
It's, I think so.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you something. Men's violence against women, you know, it happens domestically, blah blah blah. You're not a big fan of punishment, the crime and punishment system. Do you have, either am I, but I'm not sure I have a vision for the alternative way of dealing with that, although somewhere I know there is one. Do you have some kind of a vision of how restorative justice would be implemented in that kind of a...
Yeah, I mean, it's extremely complicated, right? Because on the one hand, you do want to remove a perpetrator from the community. If someone is violent, you don't want them in the community. But at the same time, I think that it needs to be more nuanced. There needs to be a more nuanced approach. We can't just say, like, we're going to lock you up and that will solve it, right? Because, I mean, what does that do? That doesn't resolve any of the conflicts. So I think that, you know, if it is necessary to remove someone from the community, there needs to be more attempts at reconciliation. than there are currently. Because if you look at things like the Violence Against Women Act, this is like the criminal justice framework for addressing gender violence.
Right.
And yet, if you look at it like, you know, 10 years in, the thing you see, like the largest impact it's had, is that more women are incarcerated because of the Violence Against Women Act. And the reason for this is that, you know, when there is a case of domestic violence, the police, if there's some kind of conflicting story, they arrest both people.
Mm-hmm.
They arrest both the man.
I'm sorry, but I have anecdotal things that directly contradict that.
Really?
Yes. I mean, here we go. Here comes the dirty laundry, skeletons in the closet. My wife is not an anarchist, and she also happens to be a violent alcoholic. Don't pass that on, please. We get in a fight, you know, and she's just drunk and mean, okay? And I don't, nothing, you know? What happens is she wants to take me outside and kick my ass. So when she steps outside the door, I pull the old cartoon trick and I lock the door, okay? So she starts banging on the door, the cops come, what's going on here? And the next thing I know, I'm in cuffs behind my back and they're asking me what the heck I did.
Yeah. Well, okay. No, I'm not saying that's true in all cases.
I'm saying that
statistically.
And it gets better, too. I mean, because I call up this organization because the cops say, well, look, my wife's drunk. I just want to take the kids and get out of here, you know, let her settle down and we'll be back. So I call this organization called WEAVE. Maybe you've heard of it. Women Escaping a Violent Environment. They're like, you know, to me, they're a bunch of self-righteous bitches. But I call them up. And I say, look, you know, here's the situation. The cops have told me, you know, I just need a shelter for the night. I have my kids with me. They're both young. And you know the response I get on the phone? Oh, I'm sorry. We don't take men.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Now,
I mean, that's unfortunate.
I don't think sexist language is really appropriate. I understand you're disclosing something personal, but it's really offensive to sit here and listen to, like, a room full of silence against, like, sexist language.
Okay. Appreciate that, and I apologize if I've offended anyone. But nonetheless, I have had major frustration because I've had personal experience where I've actually needed shelter with my kids, and I couldn't get it based on the fact that I'm a man.
But is that directly linked to, like, this particular piece of, like, legislation, this particular, like, document? I mean, that's...
Well, no,
that's... I understand that, like, I mean, obviously there are exceptions to this, and that, like, you have a particular experience with that, and I'm not disputing that at all, but I think the point that Christina was making was that, statistically speaking,
yes,
because of the way this piece of legislation and this document was crafted over the course of 10 years, there's been a overall statistical, like, sort of empirical increase in incarceration of women.
It was the absolute part of it.
Right. I'm saying that statistically, if you look at incarceration rates, and I'm not saying that anecdotally, you know, it could be a completely different case. Like in your case, for instance, it would be different. I'm saying that statistically, the legislation has not necessarily been effective, primarily because what you see is that more women are being incarcerated as a result of legislation that's trying to prevent violence against them. Do you see what I'm saying there? I'm not saying that, you know, there could be cases in which that's not necessarily true. I'm making a generalization based on statistical evidence.
The issue with respect to hate crimes, I study and consult on hate crimes on college campuses, and what we found is that as the in 1990-91, as the Hate Crime Statistics Act was passed and campuses geared up to do it, that the overwhelming number of people who were arrested and charged with hate crimes were black students as opposed to white. So it's the same thing in parallel.
Right. Yeah. I think that's more of the direction I was trying to go with that. So.
Well, not to mention that prison isn't particularly good at turning men into being less violent.
Right. And that's why I was saying it needs to be a more nuanced approach, right?
Yeah.
If it's necessary to remove a violent person from a situation, which oftentimes that is the case, okay, that's fine, but there needs to be more than that. And that doesn't necessarily happen in all contexts. And it's not a priority, and it really needs to be if we're looking at advancing human rights. So.
How does some of this play into, like, over the last few, in the last year, like in D.C., there were I think, 3 or 4 instances in which transgendered sex workers were murdered or attacked by men who had solicited sex with them and then discovered after the fact that they weren't biologically female and went back and attacked them. And I know there was a case in California recently, I think, where 3 men were acquitted of hate crimes in an identical situation. How does, like, it seems to me that in that scenario, the legislative act of it and the rights discourse end of it is actually just sort of like paper and not actually even having any sort of legal effect whatsoever because it's being circumvented. And in that sense, like, there's not really any sort of productive impact in terms of actually forwarding any sort of transformation in attitudes or standards or behaviors or anything like that. Like, is there any sort of conversation about that in the sort of women's human rights discourse?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think human rights is like, it's gendered, but it's a binary gender system. And that's really problematic because a lot of people don't fit into that that binary. And that's another problem I have sort of with, you know, the work that I'm doing for Amnesty. Is people have asked me in several contexts, well, what about transgender human rights? Like, what, we don't have human rights? Why what about violence against transgender people? Which is, the incidence of that is enormously, I mean, it's so egregious. And the answer is that, you know, a lot of mainstream human rights organizations don't have an answer because it's invisible. And that's so problematic. And so I think the role for things like that is education. And there's a group in Michigan, actually, that does transgender education. And they go to schools and they say, you know, because transphobia is such an enormous problem. And they just say, you know, they talk with people and they say, look, you know, well, what are your fears? What are your misgivings? All these things. And, you know, I don't really have an answer for, you know, preventing violence against, you know, transgendered people other than education. And I think that, you know, with that, you know, in tandem with trying to build cultures of respect, I mean, I don't think there's an easy answer to that, I guess.
But is there any attempt to, like, retool? Because, I mean, it seems like the legal and, like, sort of, in a sense, the sort of juridical mechanism that might be useful tactically, as it has been in, you know, intervening in domestic violence situations and things like that. Like, it's not ideal, but it's a tactical sort of thing that at times can be used to prevent violence or whatever. The juridical aspect of, like, hate crimes legislation against, in terms of, like, transgender people and whatnot, like, it seems absolutely, like, sort of across the board, totally bankrupt and useless. Is there not any sort of disillusionment of that or attempt to retool it?
I mean, you're talking in terms of, like, human rights conventions?
Or like in terms of people trying to, like, retool that or reconfigure that so as to be even marginally effective.
Yeah, well, I don't know, you know, obviously I don't know everything that goes on in, like, human rights discourse, but I'm not aware of any human rights conventions that deal with transgendered people. And it's interesting because the reason that there are so many human rights conventions, there's, like, I think 7 of them, is because the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was so androcentric, it was so male, white, Western oriented that activists were, like, calling for more conventions to address the needs of other people, like women. There's a convention on the elimination of racial discrimination. There's a convention on the rights of the child. There's a convention on the rights of migrant workers, which deals with immigrants and refugees. But that's interesting. I don't know of anything sort of in the works, so to speak, of developing a human rights convention on the rights of transgendered individuals. But.
Yeah, I had a question. There was a, it was about Sharia courts, mm-hmm. and I'm from Montreal, and in Ontario, maybe you read about mm-hmm. this, yeah, they were going to make Sharia courts, like Muslim law, legal in Ontario, would be problematic for women, Muslim women, you could argue. But, I mean, in the end it was struck down. But I found the anarchist response to that kind of also, I found it personally problematic in a way. There was an anarchist demonstration organized in France, called it Feminism Against Islam, or is Feminist Contre Islamisme, which I don't know if that's like the literal translation would be like fundamental, like
Islamism.
Yeah. And, but I mean, so it's kind of, I guess for me, the question that I wanted to ask was like, given that, you know, the human rights discourse would be that Sharia courts are problematic, and that, like, you know, anarchist feminists, you know, in France, and I think in some other places, kind of like, you know, picked up on that too, but at the same time, like, you know, organizing a demonstration like, you know, feminism against Islamism or feminism against Islam, like, it's also problematic in a sense too, and, or, I mean, that's my interpretation.
Well, in what ways do you see it as problematic, just so I can...
Just, I mean, because I do see the feminist critique of, like, of organized religion to be very valid, but then at the same time, kind of looking at it from, like, a perspective where, like, Muslims are so incredibly, like, oppressed in a lot of Western countries, like certainly in France, where, you know, like they ban the hijab and in public schools, and like the way I see it is like, I mean, in a certain sense, like we should also be trying to like fight the oppression of those communities. And like this just appeared to me as like a very standoffish thing, right? Like feminism against Islam. Like, you know, I couldn't really imagine like many Muslim women wanting to like ally themselves with a demonstration like that. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it all depends on context. Women living under Muslim laws is an organization that, you know, is Muslim women against Islamic law. And so in that, I don't know, are you making the claim of maybe cultural imperialism, or like, are you saying that there's a danger for women in certain contexts to, you know, to say that this is oppressive when, like, I'm not...
I guess, like, the question is, like, how, just to kind of get maybe your reaction or your thoughts on, like, the anarchist response to something like Sharia courts.
Oh, well, I mean, I can give you, like, my personal opinion, I mean, whatever merit that has, but, no, I think that Sharia courts are extremely problematic, it's really problematic for the human rights regime generally, because what oftentimes happens is when countries ratify human rights conventions, like, for instance, the CEDAW Convention or the Convention to Eliminate All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, they're allowed to make reservations, and a lot of countries that have Sharia will say, you know, we agree to this provision and it will be implemented through Sharia courts. And this has to deal with things like with like property laws and education and family law. And so, you know, if you're allowing family disputes to be settled by courts that are inherently patriarchal, in my opinion, that's extremely problematic for women, right? Mm-hmm. And that was a huge problem in Ontario, because feminists were saying, we don't want, you know, as much as we care about cultural sensitivity and you know, being sensitive to the needs of other people living in Ontario and not being Eurocentric in our values, this would be disastrous for women to take, you know, to take the control of family disputes outside of sort of a secular framework into this this framework that's really oppressive to women. So yeah, I'm opposed to that. Okay. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.